Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs to order. On this beautiful May 14th day, 2007, just to let those in the audience know, we are going to do HJM 4 first because we have a telephone conference to do, and then we will do House Bill 2517. And then 2213 will be at the very end. So for those of you who are waiting around, that's the schedule. All right. I'd like to open a public hearing on HJM 4. And Krista, do you want to describe the bill, please?
Shannon.
HJM
4 expresses support by participation by Taiwan and the World Health Organization. And we have someone on the phone from the Taiwan Economic and Cultural Society in Seattle. Okay. No, we don't. Great, Krista lost when she called Courtney.
Hello?
Hello.
Is this Director General Robert Chin?
This
is Senator Lori Moniz Anderson calling from the Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs.
Thank you.
And I have just opened a public hearing on HJM 4, which we would love to have you give some words on support for participation by Taiwan and the World Health Organization.
Yes, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And the Honor Chair Anderson and all members of the Committee, I'm Robert Chen, the Director General of the Taipei Economic Court Office in Seattle, representing government from Taiwan. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity this morning to take in your committee on the HAM 4 in supporting Taiwan's participation in the WHO. I'd like to say some words. Number one, why Taiwan is important to the global disease prevention network because each year, the Taiwan people make about 8 million trips abroad, and foreigners from other countries make about 3 million trips to Taiwan. There are about 175,000 flights arrive and depart from Taiwan. Number two, the pandemic do not discriminate, nor do they know national boundaries. Today, Taiwan serves as not only an important hub of international human and cargo traffic, but also a transit stopover for about 351 species of migratory birds around about 1.25 million in number of the birds. And if Taiwan is secluded from the WHO, it could be detrimental to the international effort to fight infectious disease such as the potential outbreak of the avian influenza, which could cost millions of lives worldwide. Number two, why the WHO matters to Taiwan? In a global community, the poor world is vulnerable to global disease. That call for a global cooperation and a global response to prevent and control. Taiwan needs direct and immediate access to the update disease control information to prevent outbreaks from taking place without any delay. Taiwan's inability to make use of this location mechanism during international outbreak hampers its disease control effort and has a strong negative impact on the health of people in Taiwan. Number three, Taiwan was heard before, not being a member of the WHO. in the year 1999, a serious earthquake happened in Taiwan. More than 2,000 people was killed. The WHO didn't send any rescue mission or medical assistance to Taiwan. In the year 2003, the SARS attacked Taiwan. There are about 664 cases reported. Taiwan relied entirely on the help from the U.S. American Center for Disease Control. Taiwan's specimens were forced to be sent to the U.S. instead of a nearby WHO office in the Western Pacific region, which caused serious delays in life-threatening epidemic control. That also bear potential cost to the rest of the entire world. Number four, why repeat our campaign each year? Taiwan needs to produce our bid to join the WHO because the WHA is held in Geneva in May each year. Today, just today, the May 14th, there's a assembly, WHA assembly will start their meeting in Geneva today. So therefore, we need to campaign each year until Taiwan is admitted to join the WHO. Number five, the Oregon legislature support is needed. The HJM number four only support Taiwan's meaningful and appropriate participation in WHO and only for the humanitarian concern. So thank you so much for your friendship and support. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Director General. Why is it so difficult for Taiwan to become a member of the World Health Organization?
We have many support from the United States, from Japan, from the Europe Union. The only reason why Taiwan is not allowed to join the WHO is because from the mainland China. They are against our participation in the World Health Organization. That's the only major reason.
So it gets down to the politics. They still want you to be a part of China. Is that the politics of everything, do you think?
Yeah, that's their thing, but we have different thoughts that because we think the health issue is only for a humanitarian concern. Mm-hmm. Everyone in the world should be taken good care of their health, no matter who you are, no matter what your position are, no matter what your party are, or you are a gentleman, or you are a lady, or you are a young man, or a woman, everyone should be taken good care. So there's nothing to do with any parties. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And do you want to hear the rest of the hearing while we pass this bill?
Yes, I can. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Listening to anyone wants to speak on this issue.
Oh, okay. Representative Butler, I think, is coming, and he's en route. So we may... When you say he's en route, is he really en route? From his office? Okay. He should be here probably within the next couple of minutes if you're willing to hold on.
Yes, I would like to hold on. Yeah, thank you.
Madam Chair, while we are waiting for the good Representative Butler, I would just like to say for the record, and this is Senator Gordley speaking, in a global community, we need to be prepared to act on behalf of nations and people who may be hit by a natural or man-made disaster. We need to act in a way that expresses our concern for humanity, all of humanity. And so I look forward to making the motion to move this memorial forward. And also anticipate hearing from Representative Butler.
Madam Chair, while we're waiting for the good representative, I'll say what I was going to say in work session on this. And for the record, for those listening on phone, this is Senator Jeff Cruz. And I was privileged to be part of the delegation that went to Taiwan last spring. And Taiwan has been a friend and ally of the United States for a long, long time. And it's unfortunate in this case that politics is trumping policy, and fully understanding potentially the dilemma at the UN, but the fact is that the World Health Organization is in some ways clear, distinct, and separate from, this isn't an ask for Taiwan to become a full member of the UN. This is just an ask for them to be part of the global community when it comes to dealing with pandemics or other natural disasters. And I was so incredibly impressed by what I saw in Taiwan and the direction they have taken that country over the last few decades. I think, Madam Chair, one of the real frustrating things at this point, because if you look at from the economic perspective, the relationship between Taiwan and mainland China is incredibly solid, and a lot of the new innovations and new economic drivers that are happening on the mainland are in collaboration with the Taiwanese government and the people of Taiwan, and they're a major trade partner for us, and I think it's totally appropriate that we keep supporting them as we will be in House Trump Memorial 4. This is not the first time we've done this. It will probably not be the last time we do it. And back to what Senator Gordley said, everybody should be a participant in good health and in the ability to deal with disasters. And that's really all we're asking for here, and it's totally appropriate. And Representative Butler was part of our delegation, and now he's going to speak.
And now, Representative Butler, please come forward.
Tom, you missed a great speech I just gave, so go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
And members of the committee. House Representative Tom Butler from District 60. Thank you for the opportunity, and I did hear part of Representative Cruz's presentation on the television, and recognize that I was late in getting down here. I beg your pardon and stampede to apologize. The House Joint Memorial 4, which is before you today, addresses something which we have continued to attempt to address over the past number of legislative sessions. And while I didn't enjoy, or wasn't able to enjoy all of Senator Cruz's presentation, I think he probably has hit upon the high points.
Well, Representative, I want you to know that Director General Robert Chen is online.
I'd understood that Director General, good morning, Director General Chen. I'd understood that he was participating, and I did want to speak on behalf of Taiwan Republic of China. It's interesting to note that approximately one-third of the population of China, of Taiwan, actually travels somewhere outside of the country's borders on an annual basis. When you consider an island nation, that's a phenomenal amount of travel. And then, of course, when you take the in-migration of people traveling in, about 10% of their population is replaced each year with people coming and going. So they certainly have interaction with the rest of the world, and they were an organization. Their health organizations, with regard to the SARS outbreak in 2003, they made significant contributions in sharing information, and they have disproportionately made financial commitments to the World Health Organization and World Health themselves. When you consider the number of people, 23 million people, in the Republic of China. Oregon's Pacific Rim location is unique with regard to our both our trade and our economies with the Republic of China and with Taiwan. I feel very strongly that we should encourage the World Health Organization to invite Taiwan to participate. The potential for pandemics is greater than it ever has been in the history of mankind because of, as I say, the ability to travel from one nation to another and the tremendous mobility that there is. And so I just can't speak enough of the great opportunity that it is to continue to support our good friend and our neighbors, folks that support the Oregon University system and who support the World Health Organization and health throughout the world as the people from Taiwan do. So I'd be happy to try and answer any questions, but with Senator Cruz and Director General Robert Chen on the telephone, I think you've got probably the basic knowledge that you need to make the correct decision here, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Further discussion?
Madam Chair, I'd just like to say good morning to Representative Butler. It's great to see you.
Good morning, Senator Gorley, and I hope that you ladies had a lovely Mother's Day, too.
Thank you.
I thought of the lovely mothers that we have yesterday in our midst, and sorry that I wasn't able to honor you yesterday.
Thank you. With that, I'll close the public hearing on HJM 4, and I'd like to open a work session on HJM 4.
Madam Chair, I move HJM 4 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves HJM 4 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Cruz, would you like to carry this?
I would be honored.
And with that, I'll close the work session on HJM 4, and I'd like to... And like to say goodbye to you, Director General.
Thank you so much.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Have a good day.
Yeah, you too.
I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2517. Shannon, do you want to give an update on what we have here?
House Bill 2517 requires health insurance policies to provide coverage for orthotic and prosthetic devices that are medically necessary. Directs the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt and update the rules listing the prosthetic and orthotic devices covered.
I think we have some great testimony today. Dr. Matt Bradley and Forrest Saxton, would you like to come forward? Good morning.
Good morning. Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matthew W. Bradley. I'm an orthopedic surgery resident in my third year of training up at Oregon Health and Sciences University. I am also the author of the piece of legislation you see in front of you. I'd like to tell you a little story, kind of giving you a little bit of background on me and where this this whole piece of legislation came from. When I was 10 years old, my family lived out on a rural part of Indiana, way away from civilization, out in the middle of nowhere, really. It was a Friday afternoon, about 5:30 in the afternoon. I was out playing with one of my friends. We had just gotten done mowing one of the big drainage ditches at the front of our property. And I turned just in time to see the front bumper of a car strike me as a 10-year-old. Fortunately, my friend Kenny didn't come to see me. He ran in and called 911 immediately and got the proper medical attention. I spent months and months in the hospital undergoing about 35 various procedures, one of which was the above-knee amputation of my right leg. And as a 10-year-old, this was pretty devastating at the time. To this day, I still hold the quarter-mile track record for my high school, which I set as a 10-year-old boy prior to this. So I was a pretty good athlete. So it was a pretty devastating time to lose your right leg as a 10-year-old. But I had a great family support, and I had phenomenal doctors that just would not let me get down. In fact, one of them paid for me to undergo golf lessons and teach me the game of golf when I got out of the hospital. But as a 10-year-old boy, and having a family of my dad being 6'5" and my mom being 6'1", I had a lot of growth ahead of me. I was also a very active kid. So when I got out of the hospital, I went through months of physical therapy and reconditioning and everything, and eventually was fitted for a prosthetic limb. I got the limb, I learned to walk, and over the next year I began becoming more and more active, able to run again, able to participate in Little League Baseball, playing pickup games of basketball around the neighborhood, which kind of left me with two problems. One, I was too active. for legs, and two, I was growing too fast to keep these things fitting. So every 4, 5, 6 months, I was needing a new leg, and it was always a game whether I was going to wear out the one I had or whether I was going to outgrow the one I had. Mothers probably understand this with shoes for their kids, as I'm going through it now with a 3-year-old girl. So every time I needed a new leg, we'd call up, we'd make an appointment to get me in to fit me for a new leg, and Dad would make a quick trip to the bank. Now, Dad at the time was working a full-time job during the day, and then was teaching courses 5 nights a week at a local university as a second job. So I knew we had good insurance. We had really good insurance through both of his jobs. And every time I needed a new leg, he'd make a trip to the bank. And he'd come back and he said, "All right, we're all ready. Let's go get the leg." I always assumed that he was going to the bank to pick up the insurance money to go pay the people to build my leg. It wasn't until I was in my teenage years and kind of understanding some of the language that Mom and Dad were saying where I realized he wasn't going to the bank to pick up insurance money. He was going to the bank to remortgage the house, cash out 401k plans, cash out retirement plans, take money out of savings, stuff like that, to the point that when I was a teenager, Mom and Dad didn't have a retirement fund. They didn't have a 401k fund. They had remortgaged their house two separate times, taking the equity that they had been building for the last 20 years out to pay for my legs. So as a teenage boy in my senior year of high school, I vowed that there'd be a point in my life where I could try and change that and try and make life a little bit better for these families who had been putting money away for years for retirement, so that they wouldn't have to spend everything just so their son could have a medically necessary leg to go to college with and to become a member of society. So unfortunately, I went to college, and then I went to medical school, which didn't allow me much time. But sometime during my intern year of residency, I decided that it was enough time delaying. It was time for me to start trying to realize this dream of mine, which was to see all amputees have the necessary legs, arms, devices, braces that they needed to go to school, to go to work. And so I began writing the piece of legislation you see in front of you. Unfortunately, I'm a doctor. I don't know how to write legislation. So along the way, I met some great people. Forrest sitting next to me with the prosthetic and orthotic industry, Claudia with the OMA, numerous representatives of the insurance industry, including John Lowell with Blue Cross Blue Shield. And we all worked together to write the piece of legislation you see before you. It's gone through a couple of amendments where I needed to kind of tighten up some of my definitions and go from there. But we've kind of worked together. And over my past 3 years in residency, I've taken care of trauma. I take trauma call every third or fourth night at Oregon Health and Science, which is one of the big Trauma One centers. So I see a lot of trauma patients. And unfortunately, trauma means bad accidents, big surgeries, and often amputations, long back surgeries, stuff like that. And these people are starting to come back to me now, and they're starting to say, "Hey, look, I'm all recovered. I'm ready to go back to work. I'm 25 years old. My insurance won't pay for a leg, won't pay for an arm, won't pay for my foot. What am I to do?" And so I'm writing all these letters of medical necessity, and I'm thinking to myself, do I have to really explain why it's medically necessary for somebody to have a leg to go back to work? It didn't make much sense to me. And I worked with the insurance industry. I worked with the prosthetics and orthotics to come up with this bill. And the intent was never to rewrite what insurance companies do or to tell the prosthetic and orthotic industry how to make these devices. It was merely just to take the medically necessary devices of prosthetics and orthotics and try and find a way to cover them, which is fair to everybody. It's fair to the people making these so that they get reimbursed adequately, and it's fair to the insurance companies so that they're not being asked to go above and beyond what is reasonable to them. And I think we've come up with some good definitions so that only medically necessary devices will be provided. And I think we've come up with a way of working this into the insurance industry where it doesn't kind of rewrite the whole system. That was never my intent. And we worked with Chairman Greenlich on the House subcommittee, and I guess beginner's luck, we got through the subcommittee, the committee on the floor without anybody coming up and wanting to say bad things about it. So I've been very fortunate so far, and I'll leave it at that, and I'll certainly entertain any questions that you guys might have, but this is something that's been kind of near and dear to my heart for quite some time, and I'm just very fortunate to have gotten this far and be able to speak to you today, and I thank you for your time and willingness to listen to me present this. So thank you.
Great. Life experiences sort of direct how our lives are where they go, and obviously your life experiences had a huge impact, and the fact that you were able to get to where you are now shows a lot of courage and stamina and obviously a lot of goal orientation. But I also want to thank, since we've just passed Mother's Day, want to give a tremendous amount of kudos to your parents. Parents who are devoted to their children and will not give up and want to provide the best that they have that's possible for their kids. And obviously you had a tremendous amount of family support. So
yes, Madam Chair, I'm a little biased, but I think I have the best parents in the world.
All right. Any other?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning to you. And obviously your experience is something that is going to shape good public policy that will impact the lives of many, many people. And I'm wondering, how might this policy affect returning veterans?
That's a great question. The answer is this policy will have minimal impact on them. The VA administration has had the foresight in seeing that providing quality limbs to their veterans that are returning, a lot of these veterans are actually going back over and doing more tours of duties. One guy is a bilateral amputee who's actually a paratrooper and is back over there serving again. But also a lot of these people that don't go back over and serve, provided with adequate limbs, they're able to provide some kind of function still within the federal government and our military system and give back instead of going on disability and all that. The Veterans Administration has a great program for these vets. They're given good physical therapy. They're provided with two different legs, so if one breaks or they want one for activity. They're provided with two limbs, and the VA does a great job. The government does a great job paying for them. But there is a certain number of vets that don't have full coverage through the Veterans Administration, mm-hmm. that lose their limbs in trauma or something else that is not covered by that system. Okay. But if they do have Blue Cross or they do have Kaiser, it'll affect that group. But the ones that are losing their limbs over in Iraq, Baghdad, or whatever, mm-hmm. those are the ones that this will affect.
Okay, very good. And then lastly, have you met Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson? He's also part of the faculty at OHSU. He's in psychiatry. You may want to look him up. You two are kindred spirits, and you're going to discover that you have stories to share with each other. Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson, OHSU.
Knight Richardson. I will do that. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay.
And one other issue that some people were thinking we needed an amendment, and we now decided we don't need an amendment, and this addresses the individual policyholder. And I just want to make sure that it is that you hear what we have been hearing, that the legislative intent is not to deal with limited benefit health insurance policies, the individual policies. And I'd like to read into the record. Nothing in this bill shall apply to specified accident, specified disease, hospital indemnity, long-term care, disability income, dental, vision, or other limited benefit health insurance policies which are payable directly to an individual policyholder. And I wanted to make sure that you were all right with that.
Yes, Manager. That's, I have spoken to those people as well, and I'm in complete agreeance with that being read in and being a part of the proposed legislation.
Because we do have members, the insurance companies are on board with this piece of legislation. All right.
Madam Chair, members of committee, my name is Forrest Sexton. I've been an orthotist prosthetist for about 24 years. I'm currently the president of the Oregon Orthotic and Prosthetic Association, and I'm here to obviously to support 2517. I'd like to take just a moment to congratulate and thank Matt Bradley and the OMA for their leadership in this particular arena. It's something that's very important. It's a national trend. Currently, up to a recent study done by the Amputee Coalition of America indicates that 60% of all amputees have had a decrease in their insurance benefit over the last 2 years. A previous study indicates that in the preceding 2 years, an additional 60% had had a decrease in their insurance benefit. What Matt didn't cover in great detail is that there's many amputees out there with good health care coverage who find that they have no orthotic and prosthetic benefit at all. Their families and friends, like Matt's family, are stuck holding the tab, and this is sometimes many tens of thousands of dollars that they need to have in order to return to productive lifestyles over time. I will say in the state of Oregon that the insurance companies have been equally instrumental in helping us advance this bill. They've been very helpful. And frankly, some of the larger insurance companies in the state of Oregon have done a reasonably good job over time of covering this benefit and would like to see it stay that way. I would also like to say, for the record, that that Section 3 on House Bill 2517, which asks the Director of the Consumer and Business Services to review the definition on an annual basis, was added to the bill with the intention of tying this bill, the verbiage of the bill, closely to what Medicare guidelines currently indicate as a definition for orthotics and prosthetics. And wasn't put in there to create a big review on an annual basis, but just to keep up with the times. I would like, in closing, just to state that if we do nothing at this time, some insurance companies are going to continue to cut coverage and benefits for this particular service. It's going on, and it's progressing. I applaud the House for passing this bill on to the Senate, and I urge this committee to recommend the passage of HB 2517 as soon as possible. And one last statement just to the question that Senator Gordley had about the Veterans Association, Madam Chair. I will state for the record, providing this service, that right now the VA system is doing a very nice job of taking care of the veterans coming back from Iraq. That they have, they're establishing the standard of care for prosthetic practice nationwide. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, having spent 25 years in this and being a veteran myself, that the veterans from Korea, World War II, and Vietnam, who are equally suffering with limb loss, find themselves as often as not opting out of the VA system and going to their private insurance company because the VA system can at times be cumbersome, especially when they're focused on something like Iraq. And those veterans, and eventually the Iraq veterans, will benefit greatly from this particular bill. And I thank you.
Further discussion? All right. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2517, and I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2517.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2517 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves House Bill 2517 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I would like to say that there are currently six states, I believe that's correct, that offer prosthetic parity. We will now be the seventh state in the nation to offer prosthetic parity, and I know you're on a mission to have all 50 states have prosthetic parity. So any other further discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And I'll carry this bill. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2517, and thank you so much for coming for your testimony.
Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Congratulations. All right. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2022, and I see Senator Metzger here and Representative Olson, who has tirelessly spent hours and hours and years on this bill. Actually, only 3 years.
This should go down there.
Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Andy Olson, State Representative from House District 15 down out of the Albany area. But good morning, and good to see you all here. The appreciate this opportunity to come before you, and I'm going to be really quick through this. You'll be receiving a letter addressed to you regarding what House Bill 2022 is all about. But as you're aware, House Bill 2022, dubbed as the Health Care Employees Protection Bill, is the product of an interim task force from last year that I chaired. I greatly appreciate the members who worked with me on this bill. It was Representatives Bill Girard, Phil Barnhart, John Lim, and Carolyn Tomei. And this bill has come a long ways from its beginning last session as Senate Bill 572. My colleague, Senator Rick Metzger here, and I worked together on this last session. And if you can recall, it did move through the Senate on your side last session, and then it kind of slowly died toward the very end as time expired in the session. Initially, the bill applied only to nurses and was much broader in scope than what you have in front of you. Numerous hours have been devoted during the interim in developing this bill. I visited three hospitals, Sacred Heart in Eugene, Samaritan in Albany General, down in Albany, and Providence in Portland. I know that most of the task force members did visit hospitals through their respective districts. I greatly appreciate the kindness and hospitality the staff from each hospital showed to me during my visits. It was a great opportunity to learn about what each of them were doing to combat violence in the workplace. House Bill 2022 has several components, and I'll just quickly go through there. Those are the 6 points that are starting on the base of that, my letter to you. It directs the healthcare employer to identify existing or potential hazards for healthcare employees. It requires management to develop and implement assault prevention and protection programs. It requires management to provide protection and awareness training to specific employees. It directs management to keep records of assaults and involving employees. It creates an avenue for employees to refuse treatment of a patient that has history of assaultive behavior unless accompanied by a second person. And it creates a retaliatory action protection of the employee by management should the employee refuse to treat a patient with an assaultive behavior. Now, you have in front of you the Dash 4 amendments, which, are, you know, you do not.
We have A2.
We have A3, or I have A3. Oh,
I don't. I have A2 is what I have.
What the Dash 4 amendments do, Madam Chair and Committee, is basically remove the ambulatory surgical centers from the bill itself, ASCs. And my reasoning behind that was I went out during the last couple months and visited three of them. Just to ensure that, because I had visited hospitals, I had not visited ASCs to see what those were all about. On March 27th, I visited two of them. One was the Willamette Surgical Center here in Salem. They basically focus only on orthopedic surgery. Also on the same date, March 27th, I visited the River Roads Surgery Center, and they do ear, throat, nose, and plastic surgery. And then on April 20th, I visited McKenzie Surgery Center down in Eugene, and they do surgeries. Well, they have about 2,000 surgeries per year, but it's basically centered around pediatric dentistry, plastic surgeries, and orthopedics. I discovered through them that each one of the centers that I did visit did have policies in place dealing with violence in the workplace, but they had not ever had an experience involving violence. So with that, that's why I came to the conclusion then in submitting the Dash 4s.
Just a question on
yes.
that. You know, I take a look at what happened at Virginia Tech and in some of our high schools, and obviously they have plans in place, but they had never dreamed that they would ever have violence in their setting. So why is it that there would not be a possibility for violence, not necessarily from their patient, but from someone else, to come in and put other people's put harm in their way?
Yeah, Madam Chair, it's a good question. Actually, the question would be, does the potential exist? Yes. All I can do is share with you from the experience and the history that you know, I noticed through the evidence that I had collected that that had not occurred. But that does not eliminate the potential.
Mm-hmm. As a public health nurse, I was going actually into dangerous situations. We had a detailed protocol on how I was supposed to act. And if we hadn't had those plans, I would not have known, never take your purse in, always sit when you're interviewing by the door. There's certain things that you don't think about when you go into a place, and so my tendency is to say there's the potential that maybe they should also have planned.
Yes.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yeah. Senator Cruz.
Well, just to comment on the Virginia Tech thing, I think any protocol you put in place isn't going to prevent it, something like that. I mean, that's extraordinary, and all the protocols in the world don't do any good when the crazy person decides to be crazy. So, but my question is, and I'm not sure, the only amendment I have is the A2, but it speaks to kind of the same thing, and I'm wondering if the 4s address the change on page 3, section 6, and why the reason for that change from an employee who provides home health to an employee of a health care employer. Is that not...
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that was a different subject.
So that, so what I'm looking at here is...
That's a situation, and for instance, when you have a home health nurse, and they know that it's a dangerous situation, that they may refuse to go into a home unless they are accompanied by a second employee.
Well, Madam Chair, and I'm not questioning the section. I was questioning this language, including, because it seems somewhat limiting, but I don't know where the A2s came from, and if we're talking about the A4s, I'd sure like to see them.
They're getting copied right
okay.
now. I've never seen them either.
Okay, and this may be premature, not knowing if the A2s are not a relevant amendment at this point. I'll hold my question until I see the 4s.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I am not questioning the need for the bill. I support the bill, but I would like to know how many cases of workplace violence or assaults against nurses or other professional medical staff have there been that demonstrate the need for the bill? Do we have any kind of data that...
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, good question. You will have other people here testify, and you'll have a lot of different perspectives come in for identifying specific evidence as to weighing in regarding your question. All I can share with you is that I have interviewed a number of nurses over the past 3 years, and there has been, I can share different instances that have not been reported, and as a result of that, that's why this bill is being moved as it is. There is a piece of it where OSHA is involved in it as well for the collection of data off of the forms 804s, and through that, you know, you could glean some information from that. But that's pretty minimal. So other than to get down hardcore numbers, I'm not going to be able to tell you that.
Thank you.
To get back to what Senator Cruz said too, Madam Chair, the whole idea on this, and as we were talking about this, if it's predictable, it's preventable. And that's a lot of the concept behind this.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, now that I have the 4s, I see my previous question is no longer relevant, so thank you for that. Assuming that the 4s are the only amendments we're looking at.
At this point in time?
Maybe 3.
Yeah.
The 3s and the 4s are the ones that are on the table right now.
Okay.
Okay. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, here in strong support of House Bill 2022. And again, as Representative Olson has said, we'll have testimony on this bill that will get to a lot of the details about it. Just a brief overview, Representative Olson and I as he indicated, worked very, very hard on this last year. You remember Senator Monis Anderson as a member of the committee. We worked so hard, this was actually the final bill that came out of my Senate Business Committee, even though I was a chief co-sponsor on it, because we worked very hard to try and get it right. And I think, except for a number of circumstances, would have passed the House as well. This has been worked on through the great efforts of Representative Olson in the interim and the committee that he mentioned. It has refined it even further. It gets to the key point, which is, number one, prevention. And to have adequate prevention, you need to know what the history of assaultive behavior is so you can make appropriate procedures to mitigate that in the future. The only thing I will leave you with, so you can get on to the expert testimony, is, and it was just mentioned, it is before you, I would commend the Dash A3 amendment to this bill. The Dash 3A3 amendment speaks to what is commonly known in the industry as dumping, and that is where a law enforcement will bring a person to a hospital setting who has, in some cases, expressed assaultive behavior, and for various reasons, rather than take them into the hospital, actually leave them on the hospital grounds, either for to mitigate the cost to the agency or for liability. The biggest problem with this is that as these people then show up into the ER, those people on staff have no idea as to the condition of this individual or what they may be bringing into the emergency room or other part of the hospital setting. And if we're talking about assaultive behavior, I think it's incumbent on anyone to, if someone has brought to a hospital facility, to know what those potential risks are. What this amendment says is that law enforcement, if they have a potential of assaultive behavior, that they need to actually escort them into the facility, and so that the people at the facility are aware of the potentials and take appropriate risks. So I would commend that to you. I think it's an important part of the bill. Other people will speak to it. But to the bill itself, again, a great commendation to Representative Olson, and everyone has worked very, very hard on this. I think this really gets to the meat of the issue. I think it's an important piece of legislation, and hope that we will be able to move it through the Senate expeditiously and into law.
Regarding the dumping issue, this would implicate the public officers or the county or whoever brought the city. They would have the financial responsibility of the care of that patient. Is that correct?
Well, I can't tell you the specifics of why all of that takes place. My own personal experience with a couple of hospitals that I've had experience with is that there's both a liability issue as well as a time issue for officers that may be involved, and there also was a potential cost issue into who might bear the potential cost. But I think the most important thing is that the fact that they're being brought to a healthcare facility means there is an issue there. It is incumbent, I think, upon on those who are bringing them to let the people know if it might involve assaultive behavior to be aware of the circumstances from which that individual is being brought onto the grounds in the first place.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Senator Metzger, good morning.
Good morning.
During the interim work, did you determine that the Department of Consumer and Business Services has the capacity to do the analysis of any workforce data? Do they have the staff to do that work, or is this a Ways and Means issue?
Senator Gordon, I'd like to defer to Representative Olson. I did not work on the interim committee. I worked on it during the session in 05.
To get to your question, Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I cannot tell you that. I can get back to you and let you know.
I think that we need to bring the others up to testify to answer some
people
of
with
questions.
Some knowledge. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Thank you. Thank you for
thank
your
you
work.
Very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up Brian DeLashmit, Susan Kuhnhausen, and Mara Barep. Barabinski.
While the others are getting seated and getting settled, I'll go ahead and begin. Brian DeLashmit, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. Your all well aware that this bill started last session as Senate Bill 572. You've heard the history. It passed the Senate with an overwhelming vote. It was a much broader constructed bill in 2005. It had responsibilities given to the OSP, Oregon State Police, for gathering data, a number of other aspects that were looked at during the interim by the special task force. And what you see in front of you then is the product of that task force discussion. Directly to the question about business and consumer affairs and whether they have the capability, they did look at that on the House side, determined that there was no substantial impact as far as the finances to send it to Ways and Means. So it went directly to the floor and passed 58 to zip on the House side. So it got a pretty thorough working, not only as far as its structure, but also the Ways and Means implications. With that, let me give you a little background before the two nurses testify. And they do have some individual stories. But the one question that was asked is, what is the extent, what's the volume of the types of cases we're talking about? And you'll hear a couple of examples today. That is one of the problems. We hear anecdotally from a number of nurses, both in this state and other states, that this is occurring on a regular basis. But the problem is, without a mechanism for reporting, which is one of the aspects of this bill, it's very tough to capture the extent of these incidents, the extent of the scope and nature of the assaults, so that you can get at the prevention aspect. And what you heard from Representative Olson is, if it's preventable, or if it's if you can plan for it, then it's preventable. It's kind of the mantra of a police officer. In the same way, is you anticipate things, and then you can actually help prevent things from escalating. So, with that, let me show you first. This is 572 from last session. And those that were on the committee recall there was 19 sets of amendments. So we really did flush this out very substantially last session. You may or may not remember, and related to the types of cases we're talking about, this headline in the Salem paper, but beating at state hospital spotlights workers' fears. And a woman who had been severely beaten, actually beaten to unconsciousness as a worker at the state hospital. These are the types of cases that we hear about. Although in this particular case the patient was found to be able to understand the implications of what they did, and in a minute I'll get into the implications as far as mental health and psych, they were in fact prosecuted for assault in that particular case. But in a number of the cases that we've heard about or seen in the state, there's no prosecution because there's no reporting. And that's the problem we have here. So this bill in itself really gets at some very primary aspects, training by the facilities to know how to react to these kinds of cases so that you can anticipate the case, your employees have the right training, you can, in essence, talk people down before it gets to the violence, which is a very valuable skill that nurses and other healthcare providers do have. Let me talk a little bit about what's gone from 572 last time. Although the bill still has the ability for BNC, Business and Consumer Affairs, intervention and penalties, they are not specifically mentioned as far as penalties in here. Under their general authority, if somebody, a healthcare facility, was not doing this, they would have the ability to intervene. But the original bill actually had in the health licensing section of a hospital the ability to penalize a hospital. That's all gone. The language about use of OSP, Oregon State Police, for gathering the data, and that separate issue about the law enforcement involvement in this is gone. So the focus really is on the facility, the healthcare provider, and getting the right data and prevention. As I mentioned, the bill passed the House 58-0. You will hear, I anticipate you will hear, because we've heard for 3 years, a couple of responses from facilities. One, there is no problem. And I guess we have two responses to that. I think we can show that there is a problem. The second thing is, if a individual facility or group of facilities don't have a problem, then they have really little or no responsibility under this bill. They already have a training process. They also have adequate reporting process. Then there's nothing additionally in this bill that should cause them any concern. So it is a very worked down over 3 years process. With that, I will let you have one additional document from me, and I won't spend a lot of time on it. But it really talks about the issues that we went through, the Tier 1 issues, data collection, and where that's in the bill. Rights to report, number two, to police, that was dropped. And we were assured that Boley, in fact, has the ability to capture that data. Patient confidentiality was a major issue, again covered under existing Boley laws. Hospital policies and safeguards, page 1, section 3. Second staff to visit violent patients is contained in there. And then home health, there is one very specific section. It's actually section 6, that only talks about home health. And that's a little bit different setting. And I don't know that either one of the nurses today are going to talk about this. But most of this bill really impacts the hospital and ambulatory surgical centers. There is a section that deals only with home health, and they don't have the same responsibility as far as the capturing the data and all the other things. But they do have, in this bill, some responsibility that when they send someone out, if there is some evidence of past behavior or some indication that there's a possibility for violence, that those nurses that go out in home health have some either ability to have some backup or have some communication device that would allow for immediate response or as immediate as possible. I know that's somewhat vagrant or not impossible, but in rural areas, the nurse response, because there may not be a police officer, there may not be someone else, home health, for immediate response, but they need to be able to communicate that there is a problem, something's going down.
There are situations where you actually have to cross the field and climb a fence in order to get to the place where you're going.
Exactly. And then the Tier 2 issues are issues about the language and self-defense that went through a number of iterations last session and during the interim of whether or not a healthcare worker has some ability to defend themselves and in what circumstances. And one of the major concerns was in the area of psych and mental health patients, of whether or not the healthcare provider themselves was or could potentially be protecting themselves if they were the aggressor rather than just responding. And I think we worked that through last session, and during the interim, it's very clear in the bill.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
Senator Gordon. Let me ask about that area. How many healthcare employers already have the kind of training programs that you envision through this bill? How many already have training programs, or how many don't?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we believe a majority of them already do, that there are just very few that do not. As far as the training programs, this just requires that all the good players and all the potential ones that don't, in fact, have that standard. The second piece that I mentioned was being able, however, capture the data of the actual assaults, and that's the major component. But in answer to your question, we believe that most of them, at least we're hearing from most of them, that they already have that in place.
Mm-hmm. So you're able to actually pinpoint or define which ones by name don't have them?
We have had discussions with Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, with a number of the major hospital systems, and the response that we get is that they already have those in place. We could perhaps have individual discussions with the others as well and find out which ones do not.
Okay.
We believe actually that most of them, or if not nearly all of them, already have policies in place.
Policies is one thing, but actual implementation of policies is mm-hmm. quite another. So.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, that's one of the concerns we have.
Okay. Thank you.
And I won't spend any more time on the rest of this, but what I tried to lay out in the Tier 1 and Tier 2 issues is the things that we went through in the thought process of not only last session, but also during the interim. And the original bill was a workplace violence bill against nurses only. This bill is, in fact, that's the one place it is a little broader than the original bill. This, in fact, is other healthcare employees as well. we felt that anyone has the interaction, whether it's an EMT working in a facility, whether it's a lab tech, somebody that has that direct patient contact, should have the same protections. And that's the one place that this bill is, in fact, broader than the last session. And with that, I'll let the two nurses who have come to tell their story today go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a new experience for me, so. Okay. Well, I'd like to thank the chairperson and this committee for allowing me to discuss why I support and strongly urge the passage of House Bill 2022. My name is Mara Barabitsky, and I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I've been a registered nurse for the past 26 years. I've had experience working in several specialty areas such as medical surgical, orthopedic, nephrology, neonatal intensive care, and high-risk maternal child transport. I'm certified to work with acute psychiatric adults and have been in this field for the past 7 years. Currently, I work as a team leader, certified staff preceptor, unit safety coordinator. Before I was injured last November, I was orienting to relief charge position. Throughout my nursing career, I've witnessed and experienced many challenging and stressful situations, such as emergency medical emergencies, death and dying, psychological responses to stress in patients, poor unit management, and the constant need to update existing skills and knowledge. I've always valued my profession and my own contributions to improving patient health. Nurses really are the eyes and ears of the hospital and the closest advocate of the patient. It's always been a physically and psychologically demanding profession and requires a multitude of skills. Unfortunately, the increased level and frequency of violence I have witnessed over the past several years toward nurses and other hospital employees at the hands of patients has been alarming. What is truly demeaning is the total lack of accountability, planning, or consequences to protect our caregivers. I will relate some of these incidents. I sat at the nursing station one evening reviewing a student nurse's documentation when a patient threw a plant into the nursing station. I called for backup, a code green, secured the student and other patients. Staff arrived along with security, but the patient bolted for the eating area. He then picked up a table and crashed it into my arm and knocked me over. He then attacked a fellow nurse who was hit under the chin and with the patient's fist. The patient was eventually secured for a time. I had severe bruising and arm pain, and my fellow nurse was on sick leave for several days. The sad thing for staff was that this patient had been refused admittance in his home county, as he had assaulted so many of the hospital staff, but our hospital accepted him without an advance plan of action or stepped-up staffing. He was put on a behavioral health plan by our director with no negative consequences. He was given chocolate for not hitting. Staff called for an ethics review, which concluded that the mission values of our hospital for respect and safety applied to the staff as well as the patients, but no changes were made to ensure staff safety. This patient went on to assault five other nurses before a social worker took the matter out of our department and went to the main hospital administration. The patient was transferred to a forensic unit 2 days later. Another episode was the admission of a very violent patient who came shackled from the emergency department for attacking staff. He was unlocked, the shackles were removed, and he was loose on our unit. This patient was very psychotic and thought he was Dracula, literally. He spoke in word salad, and he could not attend to his own needs. He did grab and try to assault staff and was eventually placed on an unprecedented 2-to-1 to monitor the patient until his transfer, I believe, to the state hospital. The lack of advanced planning could have been a lethal mistake. Upon admission, one young man was paranoid, subject to self-harm, and disliked being touched. This patient was not on a 1-to-1 for monitoring. When he was greeted by a cleaning woman in the hall, he thrust her head into the handrail on the wall and then punched her in the face. He escalated and hit a nurse who came to the aid of the housekeeper. The housekeeper was off work for her injuries for some time. The nurse suffered a sprained shoulder and was off work for 2 weeks. I was injured again in November by a patient who took my thumb and bent it backwards. It tore the capsule surrounding the tendons in my thumb and other fingers. I've needed occupational therapy to regain the use of the fingers and have had steroid injections, but I still have daily pain and discomfort, and I'm not yet back to work. Another nurse in our unit suffered a similar injury a year ago and has not regained the full function in that hand. During the last few weeks, an agency CNA was attacked and injured. The CNA redirected a patient from inappropriately touching female patients. The patient then assaulted the CNA, broke his nose, and injured his arm, and actually knocked him unconscious. A relief charge nurse had previously requested secluding this patient due to his inability to be redirected his volatile nature, but the director refused the request. 4 days prior to this incident, a mental health therapist was punched in the nose. Last week, another mental health therapist was physically attacked by a patient. Two staff members, as well as three male patients, had to come to his aid. The people I work with are asking you as legislators to assist us in improving the safety of the environment in which we work. We are health professionals. We're asking the unit management, as well as the hospital, to bear responsibility in ensuring a reasonably safe place to work. Many of us have years of experience. We are simply asking you to implement some common sense legislation that would help reduce the number of violent attacks by providing some advanced planning, training, monitoring, and appropriate staffing for the acuity. We are asking you to pass House Bill 2022.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Ms. Barabitsky?
Barabitsky, right.
At what institution did these incidents take place?
Providence St. Vincent Medical Center.
What was the last part?
Providence St. Vincent Medical Center.
Medical Center located where?
In Portland, Oregon.
Is that
closer to Beaverton, but it's Portland, Oregon address.
All right. And in your the fourth paragraph, where you're describing that a patient had been refused admittance in his home county,
mm-hmm.
because he had assaulted so many of their hospital staff, again, quoting from your
mm-hmm.
testimony. Was this information known at the time the patient was admitted to your facility?
I found out about it after I was injured. He was a very limited patient. He was psychotic, but he had an extremely violent history that followed him. His care plan did not reflect at that time preparation for that kind of stay in our hospital. I've worked at Legacy, and when we had very violent patients that I can think of, if we knew ahead of time, we would actually write out a care plan before they even arrived, at least to get us through that initial getting to know the patient. Time period. We're supposed to draw up a sort of a care plan when they first get there, but at that time we didn't have a violence risk assessment when patients would come in with that patient. We do now, but oftentimes the care planning part is not really implemented that well.
Mm-hmm.
The staffing is a huge issue on our unit also.
But your point and your testimony is that there was no advance plan,
right?
Given what was
and
known.
Even after he assaulted myself and the other nurse, the plan we all felt was inadequate,
mm-hmm.
very inadequate.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susan Kuhnhausen. I live and work in Portland, Oregon. I've been working in hospitals since 1975 and in emergency departments since 1980s. I've had the privilege to care for Madam Chair's family members in my department. I support this bill because this is such a major issue that nurses are leaving health care at a time when we can't afford those type of losses because of fears of personal safety and security in our facility. The CDC and OSHA both have significant resources in their websites. The Bureau of Labor Statistics report that there were 68 homicides in health services from 1996 to 2000. The injury rate for health care workers is 9.3% for all other health For all other private sectors, it's 2%. Unfortunately, although we do have reporting mechanisms in place to report violence or assaults in our facilities, less than 50% of all injuries or incidences are reported. The two reasons that are given to me when I ask about this is, number one, I don't have time, and why bother, because nothing is ever done. When I have called Southeast Precinct to come and deal with patients or family members who have assaulted people in our department, I've had to actually call back and say to the desk sergeant, you need to send another officer. The first one refused to take a report, and that is not acceptable to us. Community standards for behavior doesn't end when you enter a healthcare facility. Most of the injuries that are occurring in healthcare facilities are not necessarily perpetrated by floridly psychotic or demented patients. In emergency areas, the substance abuse, drug and alcohol, methamphetamine specifically, in addition to other drugs, and angry or depressed persons are more likely to assault us than someone who is totally psychotic and cannot control their behavior. It's not my intent that those persons be prosecuted. When I see law enforcement and I contact them about these issues, I remind them that we are public servants, just as police officers, and that it is not unreasonable to expect that we have the same level of protection during the course of our job. After a report is taken, we contact the DA and confirm that they have received the report and share our expectation that persons will be held accountable if it's reasonable to do so. Violence is not limited to the emergency department. Nurses in all areas of the hospitals are experiencing injuries and threats. We've had broken noses, broken legs, back injuries, ankle injuries. Less than 2 years ago, a Salem nurse who did not report his injury was pinned against a hallway with a methamphetamine user's arm against his neck. And he was reluctant to file a report. Some persons feel that it's considered a reflection on job performance if they're injured and are hesitant to file a report. So although the reporting mechanism is there, it's not working. And how to encourage facilities to make a change and also how to encourage healthcare workers to make a change is a challenge. As part of my work as an Emergency Nursing Association president, I have actually given presentations to emergency nurses on the fact that assault is a personal issue, that hospital policy does require that we report all assaults to the unusual occurrence report form. So it's not our intention that we don't have any responsibility for this issue, but we feel that we need the state to help us in tightening up the systems and providing the safety that we need. Managing assault to behavior classes can be an effective way to treat patients by training personnel how to recognize the escalation continuum, how to protect themselves if they are indeed taken hostage or harmed by someone, and not all facilities provide that. There is a policy in place in my health system about how to handle patients who are violent or family members or visitors, but there is no indication of when to call the police to file charges against those individuals. I am fortunate to work in a health system that provides the training and protection that this bill asks all facilities to provide. I believe the training that I received was a factor in saving my own life in my home when I went home after a 9-hour shift and was surprised to find a man in my home with a hammer to harm me. I was successful in overcoming that man, and my hope that is that all healthcare workers in this state receive similar training and support, and that any person entering a healthcare facility clearly understand that violence is not only not tolerated, but it will be prosecuted. Thank you.
Madam Chair. Thank you very much. What health system do you work for that
already has this managing assaultive behavior training in place?
I work for Providence Health System at Providence Portland Medical Center. I believe the Madam Chair as well as Representative Olson have toured our facilities. I believe that we do a fairly good job of providing physical barriers, security, oversight. Staffing is sometimes an issue for us, but I believe my manager is doing the best he can to help us with that. And we have annual training sessions that we attend after we do some online education in that area.
So you're at the follow-up, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. the Portland location?
Correct.
Which is that the one in 47th?
Correct, 47th and Gleason.
Great. Thank you so much for your testimony. Both
thank
of you.
You.
Great.
Actually, I do. This is Brian DeLashman. I have just two comments. You have dash threes and dash fours. The dash fours are who's covered, and that's the question that's put in front of you, is whether or not the surgical centers are in or out. And the other issue that Senator Metzger brought in front of you, that we call dumping issue, we're open to any discussion about those. We understand the discussion about dumping, the urgency of that. We would support that as long as it doesn't delay or harm this bill, either financially or vote-wise politically. The issue of surgery centers and versus hospitals is an issue that we're open to the discussion either way.
At this point, we need to move on. And we have four more people to testify, and I would like them to be very, very brief because I would like to move this bill. Jane Ellen Wydench, John Powell, Mary Botkins, up front and center.
Madam Chair, I'd also like to ask if Dave Fiscombe could attend. He didn't have a chance to sign in.
I don't know.
Can we vote?
Do I need to leave?
Oh, come on. Representative Maurer has been so patient. Go ahead.
I can be very, very brief, Madam Chair. Mary Botkin, for the record, with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We supported this bill two sessions ago. We supported it last session. We're supporting it this session. We have made some historic changes at the Oregon State Hospital in reporting and training our healthcare professionals there to be on the alert and to protect themselves against violence in the workplace. It's Oregon State Hospital is probably the worst. They're sort of the poster child for this. But having said that, we're making headway all the time. I had hoped that one of our nurses would be over here today. He could not get away from work today to come. So I'm here just to say good bill, should pass. We're in favor of it. We always have been. And on behalf of the healthcare professionals that we represent, this is a great step forward. And knowing what's happening out there is the first step always.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Madam Chair and members, we would oppose the A3 amendments. Those amendments I just saw when it was announced this morning that these amendments existed, not had a chance to talk to anybody except a former sheriff. However, the language in the amendment leaves a lot of questions, including the need for an officer to reasonably believe this person has the potential of engaging in assaultive behavior. The situations where a law enforcement officer would take somebody to a medical facility and leave them would be when the jail or the officer is finished with the person and they're not in custody, or they would escort them and stay with them and take them back. That's how medical care is provided when they're under the direction of incarceration. In this case, if somebody was overnight at the facility was being released the next day, complained that they would like to be taken to a medical facility. Now this person, this officer is going to have to make this judgment, potentially look up the record of the person. If they take them into a facility, alert the staff's going to want them to stay there. And from a manpower base, and this is just something that, given the financial state of county governments and the sheriff's offices, that we would object to. Secondly, we would like more time to discuss this issue with our association. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairwoman Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Whiteance, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems and the 57 hospitals throughout the state. Appreciate the opportunity to allow me to testify before you today. I'll try to be brief, probably not quite as brief as Mary was, but I'll do my best. Oregon's hospitals take violence against our employees very seriously. The vast majority of our systems and our hospitals have employee prevention training and encourage and have policies and procedures in place for staff to report violence against them. We can't do anything when a staff person refuses to report an incident, but we do take those incidences very seriously when we have them. Now, Senator Gordley mentioned earlier that she wanted to know which hospitals do and don't, and I've already started an email to get that out to all of our members to find out which hospitals don't have a system. But from when I first came on the Hospital Association at the very beginning of session when this was heard in the House side, everyone was telling me that they have a training program and that they do follow up on all reported incidences of violence. We are also, at the same time, not only are we committed to protecting our staff, and we would do that with or without legislation. We don't think that legislation is actually necessary because of our aggressive stance on this issue. But we also must balance the needs of our patients with the needs of our staff. We have to protect them. And Section 7 of the bill before you allows employees to act in self-defense. And we think the language in that section could be used to allow the very few, and I admit very few bad actors, to act out in violence, and then staff would management would not be able to hold those staff accountable. We think Section 7 is very problematic. We are concerned about the Dash 4 amendments that only target the bill to hospitals. We think that if there is an issue that we need to report and find out the number of workplace violence issues, that it should be all facilities, not just hospitals. And we appreciate Senator Metzger's bringing the Dash 3 amendments forward. However, we believe they don't go far enough. This really is actually, as John said, a issue of having police officers stay on site. The problem that we have, the official term for dumping, is furloughing. And what police officers and sheriff's office can do is that they give up custody of the person so that the hospital then has to treat that person under the charity care policies and uncompensated care. And then when the person walks out the door, they then re-arrest them or retake them into custody. And that's the issue that we have with dumping, is that if a person is in police custody, they shouldn't be allowed to furlough them because they should be financially liable for paying for those health care costs. I'd also like to point out that this does nothing about law enforcement taking complaints seriously when staff call 911 or call law enforcement. The bill doesn't address law enforcement. It addresses hospitals and the policies and reporting that we must do. We are closer than we've ever been before, but we are not quite there. We would wish that we had more time to actually continue to work out a compromise that would work for both our staff and for our hospitals. So thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Madam Chair,
Very briefly, I hope you heard the testimony that seemed to suggest that when, at least within the Providence system, there's one hospital that has the the managing assaultive behavior training, and then another facility that seems not to have the training in place. So that might be something that you want to look at least within the Providence system, and again, based on the testimony that we heard. Providence, Portland, at the 47th and Gleason site, has it, and then we heard that the other Providence institution close to Beaverton apparently doesn't. So
I'll let Mr. Fiskum
on that would be helpful, too.
Mr. Fiskum. Madam Chair, committee members, the record, Dave Fiscom here for Providence Health System, and I will, with your admonition, Madam Chair, be very brief. Jane Ellen has put on the record a number of the comments I thought were important to make, which is, and this is important for the record, that Providence would disagree with the basic proposition that gave rise to this bill in the first place, which is that hospital managers and administrators, including nurse managers, don't care about violence. We do. We care every day and in every way, and our goal is to both avoid instances of violence against any staff members, including nurses, as well as respond assertively when those instances unfortunately do occur. At the same time, it's important to add politically that in the best sense of the political reality in this state, we settled for the bill on the House side, and we're not trying to put a monkey wrench in the bill on the Senate side, as much as to say that with regard to the Dash 4 amendments, if numbers of violence against nurses matter in this state, they ought to matter wherever nurses happen to work, and there are a number of other places where nurses work besides hospitals, as important as hospitals may be in this equation. Just having seen both the A3s and A4s this morning, it's hard to comment on them further based on input from my client because my client has not seen those as well. I should add that we do appreciate Representative Andy Olson listening to us at a number of occasions along the way, including his two visits to Providence facilities where he saw firsthand how people on the ground deal with issues that are dealt with to some degree, at least in this bill. As for what two Providence facilities do, I will need to check Senator Gordley with that to make sure, but my understanding is that we have policies throughout our system that deal with training for staff in an attempt to both avoid violence as well as respond to it if unfortunate. The unfortunate reality is that violence sometimes does occur. The difficulty of responding off the top, in the House side, I would say one of the notions that some of us had along the way was that we ought to avoid the risk and difficulty of competing anecdotes, as true as anecdotes might be. And I could have anecdotes on, quote, my side, unquote, which would talk about management response and difficulties of response. And so I'm not prepared today to speak to either of the two communications you've received from nurses at two Providence facilities. Would be pleased to send those communications to Providence and ask for responses to them. I'm not prepared today to do so. I think your view of this bill should reside in the policy, if I might, Madam Chair, say that, as opposed to the anecdotes you might hear on one side or the other along the way, as important and as compelling as those might be to you as you hear them, as I have for the first time today. I'll stop with that and say we're prepared to accommodate this bill and to live with it. At the same time, we hope you recognize our commitment to avoiding violence wherever it occurs and responding aggressively to it when it does occur. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I appreciate, thank you very much, Mr. Fiscom, and I do appreciate that the testimony that we heard from the two nurses can be characterized as anecdotal. However, what I'm asking you to follow up on specifically is how the policy is being implemented and whether there may be or maybe there isn't unevenness in the implementation of the policy. Don't know, but let's find out. Is that clear?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I wrote notes a while ago when you said what you said, and it is clear. Thank you for the clarification, however.
Thank you.
We have one more person to testify on this, and I do plan to go till 10:15, or we have to be on the floor at 10:15. So Sarah Myers, and then Representative Maurer will at least start your bill. I'm not sure how far we'll get with it. We'll start.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Sarah Myers. I'm the Executive Director to the Oregon Association for Home Care. I will be brief as well. I think throughout the discussion of this bill in 2005 and now in 2007, the Oregon Association for Home Care has been in opposition to this bill, primarily for the reason for which the application of the bill continues to be in it, and it is in its current form today. And that is that it basically is imposing a new mandate on half of the home care agencies in the state that are hospital-based, and the rest do not have to comply with this, nor do in-home care agencies, nor do hospices, nor do nursing homes, nor do assisted living facilities, and many other multitude of provider types. As Mr. Fiskum previously testified to, it seems to be an unbalanced approach if, in fact, what we really are seeking to do is to protect caregivers and also to protect the patients and in any setting. We had heard during the 2005 session from OSHA with respect to assaults, there were zero reported assaults in home health. So with the respect to the fact that there are no documented cases in that, we still continue to have some frustrations over why in which we would have a unbalanced application of this bill to only a partial sector of the industry. It just does not make any sense other than to, in my opinion, editorially to say that it seems to be somewhat of a political assault on a very minimal set of providers. I just continue to not understand that and unfortunately don't have or have not yet received a response on that. So respectfully, I would just simply say that you know, with the cost barrier, and in addition, there are two other points I'd like to make with respect to the application of Section 6 of the bill to home health providers, and that is the requirement of adding a second person to the delivery of home health services. In many cases, especially in rural areas, there may not be a second person to attend with a nurse to a patient who may live 50, 100, 200 miles away from the nearest facility. So that would be an additional cost, not to mention the fact that the facility may have to consider elimination of home health services altogether because they would not be able to comply with that. Another aspect of this bill, which is in Section 6 as well, is the requirement of a communication device. In many areas of this rural state, we have the only ability is a satellite phone to the cost of $100 plus the cost of the service and maintaining it. An additional cost such as that to provide to caregivers may, you know, number one, if they're 100 to 200 miles away from the nearest facility, may not do anything for someone who is being currently assaulted. So I'm not quite sure exactly how that gets at protecting the caregiver, only to say that it additionally adds to the cost of providing care and an additional issue for the facility or the home health agency having to comply with that requirement. So respectfully, I see that the ambulatory to surgical centers and the Dash A4s are being considered to be removed. We have contested this entire time that if indeed really the issue is hospitals, then perhaps that should be the focus versus sweeping in a partial section of the home health industry and no other provider types. So with that, I'd entertain any questions. I'd be happy to answer them.
For the record, I want this committee to look at being more inclusive regarding the home health issues. I feel we have a good bill now. It's not a perfect bill, but I don't want to stop the process of this bill. And so there are two things that I will definitely want to look at in the interim is the home health issue regarding communication devices. Having worked in the rural area, I really feel, and it's going to, I think, happen more and more. We're on the cutting edge, I feel, in providing home health services, and it can be. It's in the best interest of the patient, but we've got to really address the safety. And if it costs $100 for a satellite phone, I'd say I think that's a necessity that we need to have, as well as looking at what a second employee will be. But I think that's something that we definitely, as well as looking at including those other agencies, because I feel you make your point is well taken, that it shouldn't be just focused on a very certain group. But I would like to be working on that in the interim and get more testimony. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate mm-hmm. that.
Thank you. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on HB 2022. I'd like to open a work session on HB 2022. We have some amendments, and I think if Shannon can take note of the things I want to address during the interim regarding the home health issue, which I think is extremely important, but I also want to address the issue of the dumping. I think that's a more complicated issue, and I know that I have Michael Wood, administrator from the DCBS, Department of Consumer and Business Services, who would comment on that. But I feel that this is going to need a lot more vetting than we have time this session to do. So I would like to also have that on the list to do during the interim also. All right.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2022 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves House Bill 2022 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Well, Madam Chair, I will, not to slow down the process, I will vote yes on this in committee. I think there, and I appreciate you not putting the amendments in, because this is a work group product, and with all the vetting they did on the House side to bring last minute amendments is somewhat troubling to me. But also, to a large degree, I think this may be an unnecessary bill, so I reserve the right to change my mind on the floor.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, I did hear in the last witness testimony a reference to political assault on providers, and I'm not quite sure what that means. But it's troubling to hear the phrase. I just don't know what that means. I'm prepared to vote in favor of the bill.
Thank you. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Excused.
Senator Courtney?
Excused.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Gordley?
Aye.
And Mom Sanderson?
Aye. Motion passed. And the carrier will be Metzger, Senator Metzger. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2022. And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2946, Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Ron Maurer, House District 3, and I bring House Bill 2946, which passed unanimously on the House floor. And this bill is, at its core, about health care reform and health care reform on the delivery side. And I will refer to this as the Kohler Project, and this project was brought to me by former President of OHSU, Peter Kohler, and he is very interested in testing a model of delivery that extends the use of certified nursing assistants, licensed practical nurses, and 2-year RNs to the maximum of their skill level through leveraging technology. And the technology that he is very interested in is a program called, what is it called? It's called LifeCom. And LifeCom is an algorithm-based computer system that he refers to as artificial intelligence. And what we are looking for in this bill is a permission for DHS to request a waiver from CMS to use this program on a population of Medicaid patients that currently are in the system, and then report back as a study. And what he needs specifically is a large group. And we're looking at something on the order of 10,000 people, which can be divided into multiple sets. But this bill is not about CMS spending more money. This is not about CMS doing something outside their normal way of providing services within the state. This is about looking at a system that we know is fundamentally broken and that is not sustainable, because we do not have enough nurses in the system. We do not have enough nurse practitioners and physicians. And so we have to come up with creative and innovative ways of addressing this need as we go forward. I have Brian Boehringer from OHSU. Peter Kohler was unable to be here today. And if you have questions of myself, or Brian, unless he wants to say anything, I will conclude my remarks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brian Beringer with Oregon Health and Science University. I'm not going to, I knew you're crunched for time, and unfortunately we do not have the team to demonstrate the project, but let me just say that OHSU supports this wholeheartedly. The bill actually allows for any number of pilot projects to try to find some efficiencies in our current Medicaid system. I will say that the project that Dr. Kohler is working on is a multi-tier clinical trial. The first part was a small clinical trial done with Outside In, and that is, I believe, close to completion, so there is some data available if you want to look at that. And this project, the CHAMPS project that Representative Maurer talked about, is a project that we would like to suggest as a pilot project for the legislation, but just to make clear that the legislation really could open the door for any number of pilot projects that look at these sorts of efficiencies. So,
okay. Yes.
And if I want to add that we're not looking at ways to reduce quality of medicine. This is about keeping the quality of medicine that we have today, which isn't always perfect. But this is about using the resources that we do have more efficiently.
Does DHS want to make a comment on this bill?
I would hope they would.
No one signed up, but...
Good morning. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Department of Human Services. Chair Mona Anderson, this bill was amended. We had some concerns at first, but the bill was amended, and we are wholeheartedly in support. We will ask CMS for a waiver, and in light of all the different health care bills this session that have looked at new and innovative ways to do things and be more efficient and move forward with health care in a different way, we think this is a good step in the right direction to at least pilot a new idea and see how it works.
Right? I support this. I think to allow them to begin the process, it might be appropriate at this point in time, and then when we're back in February, we can see how things are going, because we won't have a waiver by then, but we'll see. Well, reality is reality. So, it would be something we could get probably a progress report on in February. So,
Chair Mona Anderson, Senator Cruz, we'd be glad to make that happen and work with both OHSU and Representative Maurer to kind of help pull that together. I did see the example. They did do the slide presentation on the other side, and it was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool.
Done her task.
All right.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just one clarification. What is the meaning of currently underserved population as it relates to this bill?
Which line are you referring to?
Well, actually, you know, I'm not looking at a line of the bill. I'm looking at the OHSU testimony. I should have directed my question
well,
to...
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, mm-hmm. the term underserved is, in my world, is a very strict definition that's set by the federal government. And OHSU and their Office of Rural Health they have been given the authority for Oregon to define within various programs what we mean by underserved. And so there are, I won't say technical definitions, but there is a definition for underserved areas.
Mm-hmm. And again, I'm looking at the written testimony from the, is it Mr. Beringer?
The bulleted at the bottom of the page.
That first bullet.
Madam Chair,
expanded access.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, this is actually Dr. Kohler's testimony, mm-hmm. and to prevent myself from going off into areas that I don't belong in, let me get that answer for you and bring it back to you.
Okay. It caught my eye because a part of what this project will be doing is,
I think it's a good thing,
some work around multi-stage clinical trial, so I'd like to know specifically what populations are we talking about and with what intent. Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we can get that for you. And additionally, we could actually do the demonstration if we can find some time to schedule as well. It is interesting, but I'll get that answer
that
specifically.
That would be wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Further discussion? With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2946 and open a work session on House Bill 2946.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2946 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gorley moves House Bill 2946 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and I'll close the work session, House Bill 2946. And was there anyone here to testify on H.J.R. 34, the colorectal? Okay. And we will be carrying that over to next Wednesday, and we'll also carry over House Bill 2213. There are some new amendments that just came out this morning, and we will carry that over to Wednesday also. With that, we're adjourned.